Here is Uncle Don back again with the 313th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. On my last show, I lamented that I had received encouragement from listeners in the United States, but not from Canada. That was not quite right. I did hear from Jeff at CHLS in Lillooet and Bill at CJLY in Nelson, but they both work at their respective stations and aren't casual listeners. I can now add one more Canadian to that list. That's Tom, the station manager at CJAI in Amherst Island Public Radio in Ontario. I found that his station has been rebroadcasting my shows for a couple of years now. I'm flattered beyond words. And now a contest to the first person correctly guessing why the number 313 is of significance to me. I will award a classic Walt Disney comic from the 60s or 50s, my choice. Send your answers to me, care of the gracious station manager, who will forward them to me. The email address is stationmanager@cfur.ca. Think. I was pleased to learn that the sovereign state of Alberta has again leapt to the forefront of protecting the rights of its citizens. We should give thanks that Alberta exists as a buffer between British Columbia and the godless masses of Eastern Canada. In this case, the Alberta legislature enshrined the power of parents to protect their children from teachers who preach about sexuality and alien religions in their classrooms. Henceforth, pedagogues will have to give advance notice to parents when these subjects are up for discussion so the wee ones can be yanked from class and shielded from dangerous thoughts. When will British Columbia's legislature wake up and pass similar laws here? Our grandson is about to enter grade 6. It's come to my attention that he's been subjected to mathematics involving Arabic numerals. I'm going to demand the right to haul this impressionable youth from mathematics classes. I won't allow terrorists to dictate how my grandson should calculate. They said that those terrorist Arabs invented zero. Talk about nothing. If Roman numerals were good enough for our ancestors, albeit they were somewhat distant, they're good enough for our grandson. And languages, they're teaching him French. I say, if English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for our grandson. It's about time to follow Alberta's education system if we want to prepare our children for the 21st century and Armageddon. A couple of items in the news caught my attention. The first is that Pepsi-Cola has a new advertising campaign running for a concoction they call Pepsi Max. This promotion involves a fattening of the peculiar streak across a circle that is Pepsi's trademark. When queried about the new design, the man responsible came across with the following, quote, explanation. The Pepsi DNA finds its origins in the dynamic of perimeter oscillations. I'm glad that he cleared that up. And in a recent interview with one of the astronauts who has visited our moon, he admitted that he wants to return to see whether his daughter's initials, which he scraped into the dust, are still intact. There's the moon's first graffiti. What next? Pepsi adds. And I see the economic downturn has finally hit street workers. There's a sign here at the near the local A&W advertising two teens for $6. Statistics can tell grand lies or they can reveal great truths. Here's one that doesn't lie. The average Canadian household owes 136% of its annual income. This gross figure does not reveal the distribution of $1.3 trillion owing. Someone's carrying our family's share. Nor do we know what collateral, if any, lies behind this debt. Some personal debt is legitimate. For those for whom renting is impractical, usually must negotiate a mortgage. It's questionable whether it's wise for either borrower or lender to enter into a mortgage too large a percentage of the price. We now well know that home values do not increase inexorably and that debt can become more than the collateral. A vehicle can be necessary for those stranded in suburbs without good public transport. Borrowing for a reliable car is often necessary, but the same danger lies if the loan is greater than the resale value of the collateral. Certainly borrowing on homes and vehicles can be justified, but if one hasn't the price of a bungalow, should one go into hock for a McMansion? If you can't afford a used Chevrolet, should you take a loan for a Lexus? Extravagant choices by millions of families compound into a massive social problem when asset values falter. For decades, family debt has risen on artificially low interest rates, aggressive advertising, and exuberant optimism about income security. Here in Prince George, we see the fruits of unrealistic expectations. Garages bulge with expensive toys, while fancy trucks sit out in the weather. Snowmobiles, trail bikes, and all-terrain vehicles rip through the countryside and rural public roads. How many of these obnoxious, useless vehicles are paid for? Mallwart is swarmed by shoppers scooping up cheap, shiny Chinese junk. How much of these purchases from the stores of the world's richest family are added to credit card debt? We don't know and don't find out until a mill like Canfor's Rusted operation shuts down and cuts off the stream of income feeding the debt of workers. We allowed, nay, encouraged, increase in household debt as finance purchases kept the whole chain of consumption running in high gear. Retail jobs were based on increases in debt. Wholesale jobs depended on those retail sales. Manufacturing work, such as was left in Canada, depend on retail sales. We did not know, or did not admit, that we relied on this upward momentum just to keep the status quo alive. When the chain of finance faltered, the system began to collapse. This brings me to corporate debt. Corporations borrowed to the hilt using cheap debt to magnify profits. Again, this worked fine on the way up, but is disastrous in a contraction. General Motors is a prime example of what happens when debt is overwhelming for a company, making the wrong amount of the wrong product at the wrong price. At the expense of billions of public dollars, governments are propping up this zombie corporation in fear that ripple effects of its failure. Everyone hopes for an orderly unwinding of the massive overhang of debt. Moving it from private to the public is a short-term patch, but no matter where this ends up, it will have to be paid by consumers as they cut back on consumption. The effects will ripple through the world economy, cutting jobs and shrinking international trade. It'll be painful, but there's one possible bright spot on the horizon. With governments carrying the huge costs of servicing debts, perhaps they will have to rethink the massive waste of resources involved in wars and preparations for wars. Are you listening, Barak? Stephen? One result of economic retrenchment that I welcome is an unwinding of globalization. While sold to us as a panacea bringing better living for all participants, removal of trade barriers increased profits while moving lucrative jobs to offshore low-wage jurisdictions. Remember the glee when we established trade relations with China? A billion anxious customers waiting to buy Canadian goods. Bullshit. A billion desperate workers waiting to perform our industrial jobs for a pittance. Lowering trade restrictions and abolishing tariffs have made way for gutting labor standards in industrial countries. Corporate owners can depress wages and win concessions under the threat of packing up and moving overseas. Under Mulroney's free trade deal with the U.S., many Canadian manufacturers moved their operations to America's Bible Belt, where underpaid workers were enthralled to preachers, telling them that unions were the work of the devil. Then came NAFTA, and those same companies moved on to Mexico's Maquiladora, where hungry peasants would work for subsistence wages, assembling goods for Canada and the United States. Now many of those factories in Mexico are closed as industry moves on to China, and from there to even poorer countries. Today's economic reversal is causing protectionism to creep back, in spite of all manner of free trade agreements and the rules of the World Trade Organization. The U.S. is ignoring NAFTA by tying stimulus payments to Buy American clauses. They're hampering shipment of goods to the U.S., using supposed national security procedures to make transport difficult and expensive. Back in the early days of both the U.S. and Canada, industrialization was accomplished behind high tariff walls on imported goods. Those duties were the major source of government revenues. With the abolition of tariffs, companies were able to move operations offshore and import their products without impediment. And governments not only lost tariff revenues, but they were forced to cut taxes and regulations to match lesser overseas standards and costs. We found that we were engaged in a race to the bottom with no floor in sight. Harper brags that Canada has some of the lowest corporate taxes in the G8. Yes, but at what cost? A projected $50 billion deficit, a social safety net that is shredded compared to what it used to be, a shrinking of the same industrial base it needed for taxes on payrolls and profits to finance necessary government operations, and frivolous ones like Harper's pet war against Afghanistan. One severe loss for Canada when we entered the FTA was the Auto Pact with the U.S. Under that agreement, motor vehicles imported were charged a large duty, but this was waived if there was one vehicle produced here for each one imported. Thus was Canada's lucrative branch plant auto industry supported. With the auto pact subverted, the former Big Three were free to produce wherever they pleased. This worked for a while, but now we're throwing billions at those companies to save them from their own follies. There are no longer even any guarantees that any well-paid, or formerly well-paid, jobs will remain here. We can't stop companies from closing their Canadian factories and moving all manufacturing to the States, or to China for that matter. With any luck, nationalistic protectionism will grow everywhere, and we'll be able to repatriate good industrial jobs along with industries along with their jobs. And our government can then glean money from tariffs on imports to pay down the massive debts we're accumulating while still financing social services and maintaining our physical infrastructure. The 20th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre is behind us. Our media picked up on the story that most university students in Beijing are either unaware of that portion of their history or in denial. This is being used as an example of the pervasiveness of the Chinese propaganda apparatus or the power of intimidation. Perhaps. Well, then how do we explain that surveys of current students at Ohio's Kent State University reveal that most are unaware of the massacre that took place on their own campus in 1970? Four students protesting the Vietnam War were shot to death and many injured by members of the Ohio National Guard on their campus. Why don't they know? Can we blame their ignorance on propaganda or an intimidation? Perhaps they consider a tragedy like this, happening 39 years ago, was so long ago that it is conflated in their minds with ancient history, like the Civil War and the American Revolution. This massacre of American students by American soldiers, although much smaller than Tiananmen in number of victims, was considered a tragedy at the time and may have been one event leading to the withdrawal from that miserable war. As with other events like the Watergate fiasco, the cover-up was as much news as the shooting itself. The officer in charge of the troops immediately confiscated soldiers' rifles and mixed them up so the killers could not be identified and no one was ever prosecuted. Another aspect of this time was the way the press ignored a concurrent travesty at another American university. This was a police killing of two war protesters at Jackson State University in Mississippi. It was speculated that there was good reason why the press didn't pay attention to these killings. Jackson State was a black university. Is it reasonable to call these events massacres? These two shootings on campuses saw more deaths than the much ballyhooed Boston Massacre of 1770. Before we jump on China for failure to commemorate their massacre, we should look at the way North Americans handle their own. Canada, or at least the Harper regime, is one of China's chief benefactors. Surely China's leaders will remember favors rendered and respond in kind. For instance, look at Harper's announcement that we will change the focus of our foreign aid, miserly as it is, from the African continent to Latin America and the Caribbean. There was a time when government believed that trade follows aid, but the conservative regime has reversed this. Harper will now be sending our largesse mainly to those nations with which we have new free trade agreements. Cut off will be Malawi, a fledgling democracy, recipient of Canadian aid of $440 million over the years, aid which has allowed it to begin pulling itself out of poverty and into responsible government. 5 years after opening a new Canadian embassy in Malawi, we're closing it while abandoning ongoing development programs. Being abandoned along with Malawi are some of the most impoverished nations on the planet. Benin, Burkina Faso, Cambodia, Cameroon, Guyana, Kenya, Nicaragua, Niger, Rwanda, Sri Lanka, and Zambia. As Canada withdraws from these nations, most of which are African, what nation do you suppose will step into our tracks quite willingly? China. The Chinese have been investing heavily in Africa, making trade and aid deals aimed at assuring their access to resources, mainly oil. They'll gladly fill our vacant shoes in exchange for exclusive access to African agricultural and mineral products. When the smoke clears, we may be surprised to find these nations no longer wish to trade with us, shutting us off from vital imports. At least we will have new friends just added to our aid recipient list. Afghanistan, Caribbean nations, Colombia, Haiti, Peru, Sudan, and Gaza's West Bank. Most of these countries are notable for their exports of illegal drugs. Good choices, Stephen Harper. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Congratulations to both Americans and Canadians. We collectively own the skeleton of what was once the grandest automobile manufacturer on the planet. Americans have the added joy of possessing large chunks of many financial institutions of negative value. It remains to be seen whether this makes us all capitalists, socialists, or just suckers. We live in fascinating times about which books are being written as I speak. The flip side of fascinating is frightening. Where in the hell are we going? There's a general consensus that huge, rapid nationalizations were necessary to save private companies, which were too big to fail. The fear is that, if allowed to collapse, these monsters would take down hundreds of smaller companies, leaving millions of unemployed. Nationalization was seen as the least bad solution. We can't foresee the future, but we can examine the past. How did a capitalist economy develop financial and manufacturing entities so pervasive they could not fail without taking the system down with them? A virtue of capitalism, in theory, is that it has the flexibility to adapt readily to changing times and technologies. In the ideal, a successful economy is composed of many enterprises, sole proprietorships, partnerships, and corporations owned and controlled by stockholders. In each industry, these outfits compete, with those best able to adapt to changing times, prospering while those less well-run or unlucky perish. The theory as taught in elementary economics courses is flawless. Teachers have the graphs and formulas to prove that such a system will maximize growth, guarantee full employment. Individuals save money, and that money is transformed via banks into investment funds for businesses. Everybody wins. When the rubber hits the road in the real world, we see a somewhat different outcome. The dirty little secret of unfettered free enterprise is that competition's winners eat the losers like fish in the sea. Money and power work up the food chain, with the ultimate act finding a single entity at the top of each industry. A function of government in our system is to freeze this progression at the stage where there's still a number of competing firms in each field. A classic case of free competition ending in monopoly occurred in the United States around the turn of the last century. With the birth of the automobile, oil became a major industry. By 1911, John D. Rockefeller and associates had cornered American petroleum from the wellhead and refining through transportation and right up to the neighborhood gas pump. They had this sewn up so tightly that no one could challenge them. From 1870 to 1911, the Standard Oil Company crushed all competition ruthlessly. Faced with a monolithic monster exercising a stranglehold over the American economy, the administration of President Theodore Roosevelt exercised the Sherman Antitrust Act to break the Standard Oil Trust apart. In 1911, the Supreme Court ordered the dissolution of its holdings into 33 separate competing entities. Over the last century, these companies have gradually coalesced back into a handful. For instance, only recently we saw the re-merger of Exxon, formerly Standard Oil of New Jersey, with Mobil Oil, formerly Standard Oil of New York. Looking at identical gas prices marching up and down in lockstep, we see this exercise in forcing competition has been a failure in the oil industry. There's a parallel between the Standard Oil Trust and the growth of the General Motors into a monster too big to fail. Automobile manufacture is not a business favoring small enterprise. It requires large investments in plant, equipment, and dealerships. It's a complex system of making or procuring parts, assembling, selling, servicing, and promoting the products. The foundation for General Motors was laid by William Durant, a carriage maker who in 1904 took over ailing Buick Motors. He later combined Buick, Cadillac, Oldsmobile, and Oakland companies to form GM. At the onset of World War I, there were 104 U.S. manufacturers of cars. In 1921, there were 44 left. By the time of the Great Depression, the Big Three, GM, Chrysler, and Ford, had become the largest producers of vehicles, competing against a gaggle of smaller outfits, including Hudson, Nash, Packard, Studebaker, and Willys Overland. Subsequent years have seen all Canadian U.S. manufacturers but the Big Three fail or be absorbed. General Motors has come to include divisions we now know well. Cadillac, Oldsmobile, Pontiac, Chevrolet, Hummer, Saab, Saturn, and Opel are familiar labels of GM. Synergies in management, common parts, advertising, and combined dealerships gave this huge entity the profitability to become paramount among blue-chip stocks to own. It could never fail to lead the industry. But size led to rigidities and complacency. These were compounded by government failure of oversight as General Motors gobbled the competition, building up unsustainable debt and obligations. Negotiated labor contracts included unfunded obligations, which have now caught up with them. Pension money, which should have been invested in safe instruments calculated to mature as workers retired, were instead gambled in equities. Funds' growing paper values prompted Ontario, for one, to allow GM to skip payments to pools that appeared to be above what would be needed for future pensions. That was a major screw-up coming to light as values collapsed. GM managers, looking only at short-term stock gains to justify their bloated bonuses, failed to recognize the long-term trend away from SUVs and huge pickup trucks towards small, economical vehicles. Big vehicles earn big profits. Small cars sold into a competitive market yield minuscule profits when produced in a high-cost North American environment. Very large fixed costs were easily covered by growing sales, but when the market contracted, they brought massive losses. This is where we are now. Due to legislative complacency, GM has grown so large, intertwined as it is in the entire economy, that its collapse would cause ripples everywhere. Obama and Harper are scared stiff that the fall of GM and Chrysler could cause a cascading effect impossible to ameliorate. It's panic and fear driving this huge public investment in GM, not hope. If we can extricate ourselves from this god-awful mess, will we learn from it? Will companies, manufacturing and financial, be trimmed and divided to where anyone can be permitted to go out of business without threatening the whole economy? Or will governments permit monster companies to remain too big to fail, laying the groundwork for the next big panic? The choice is collectively ours. We have to hand it to our wise leader, Stephen Harper. He's an economist, after all, and he must know what he's doing. He knows that the path to recovery is investing public money in General Motors, which may never make any money. He wants to finance this partially through the sale of government enterprises, like the Royal Canadian Mint, which does nothing but make money. I guess I'm just too dumb to be an economist. It's said that Harper is the smartest man in the room, especially when he's alone. Apropos of nothing, I just learned that India's Congress Party chose a tune we might recognize as their campaign song in their past election. It was Jai Ho, translated as Let There Be Victory, from the film Slumdog Millionaire, a British production. You learn something useful every day. The upswelling of anger by residents of our province who cannot acquire enhanced driver's licenses at their local ICB offices mystifies me. Residents of Terrace, for instance, complain that they must drive all the way to Prince George, where the nearest machinery exists for reading their irises or whatever it takes to affirm their identities. These new enhanced licenses containing radio frequency identification chips are accepted by U.S. border guards in lieu of Canadian passports. Embedded chips allow a remote reader to prompt a response from these licenses. Those who receive enhanced licenses are warned to carry them in a special shielding case until approaching the border in order to prevent unauthorized reading. Assurances have been given that these chips will not contain personal info, but only a numerical code which U.S. border folks use to access the information from a Canadian data bank. No problem. All is secure. Do you believe the system is impermeable to abuse? If so, I expect you to buy lottery tickets using the numbers on your fortune cookies. Any system that one can invent, another can circumvent. Someone will penetrate this system sooner or later. So why the urge to pay extra for a pipeline into your personal information? The only use for this item is to cross the U.S. border. What's the matter with a passport, which is good for all borders? Those in Terrace can obtain one of these without leaving their community. Quit whining and do it. No offense to Americans, but I personally have no compelling reason to enter a country with a record of snatching Canadians and shipping them off for torture in Syria. I have my passport allowing me to visit more welcoming countries where I'm not greeted like a potential terrorist. President Obama's new energy secretary has startled environmentalists. He announced a slowdown in development of hydrogen-powered vehicles, cutting new project funding by 60%. His rationalization was, quote, we ask ourselves, is it likely in the next 10 or 15 or even 20 years that we will convert to a hydrogen car economy? The answer we felt was no, close quote. Uh-oh. Where does this leave Premier Campbell's plan to create a hydrogen corridor between British Columbia and California? How much effort and public money has been put toward this dead-end project? We don't know. We know that although burning hydrogen produces only water as an effluent from the tailpipe, it takes energy to separate hydrogen molecules from their chemical bonds. Wherever hydrogen is produced, the process releases carbon dioxide and other pollutants. The promotion of hydrogen as a fuel is a red herring dragged across the trail to direct our attention away from meaningful attacks on pollution. Campbell proposes using electricity to produce hydrogen at a time when our hydroelectric resources are stretched. An added shortfall due to hydrogen separation would add impetus to privatization of public power. His regime is already adding expensive private power to inexpensive public supply, diluting British Columbia's advantage of cheap electricity. Hydrogen power is not clean and green when achieved at the cost of selling off our rivers, increased burning of coal, or construction of nuclear power plants. Dick Cheney plays a dangerous game. He's using every medium he can to spread two related ideas. He claims that torture, as practiced by American officials, is not actually abhorrent, but merely enhanced interrogation. And he says that it works. Dick tells us that torture of prisoners has extracted information about planned terrorist attacks, enabling their prevention, therefore saving American lives. The implication is that Barack Obama, by prohibiting the practice of torture, puts the U.S. in danger of terrorist attacks. His claims seem far-fetched, but they have a purpose. First of all, by claiming that torture is not torture, he attempts to exonerate himself from prosecution for violation of national and international law. But that's minor. The insidious aim is preparing Americans to blame Obama for any future attack on the United States. Such an attack would immediately be placed at the feet of the new president for being soft on prisoners. Right-wing nuts slaver over the prospect, so much so that it is not beyond the realm of possibility that one of their groups might even fabricate a terrorist attack themselves for political purposes. Keep that in mind should that terrorist incident transpire. On that happy note, I conclude the 313th edition of the Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Perhaps we should follow the example of our national leaders. When life hands us lemons, make hand grenades. Who pays attention to lemonade?